This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Thanks so much for coming out tonight. I'm Doug Fine, a New Mexico writer, and thank you so much to the Lannan Foundation for sponsoring this fantastic series. In preparation for tonight, I've been listening to some of the past events on their website, and it is truly an honor to be here. So I am so truly delighted and honored to be here introducing, and later tonight following his talk, speaking with Lester Brown. Talk about being part of the solution. For policymakers around the world, including leaders in China and the U.S., Les Brown is sketching the solution. Plus, he used to grow tomatoes, which is a current preoccupation of mine here in New Mexico, though I measure my harvest in the tens of pounds, and he, rather famously, in the tens of tons, while he was still in his teens, by the way. A comprehensive introduction for Lester Brown would take up the whole evening, but even if you think you aren't familiar with the World Watch and Earth Policy Institutes he founded, you actually are, as their reports on world ecological, population, and health issues have for decades prompted mainstream journalists to put them on the public agenda. He revealed himself as a high achiever early, achieving farmer tycoon status soon after college, working for the U.S. Foreign Agricultural Service and saving a few million people in India from starvation in the process of learning that the world is an interconnected ecosystem, sort of before his time, and founding the now legendary World Watch Institute in 1974. He later founded and is now president of the Earth Policy Institute, and he's been awarded the MacArthur Genius Fellowship. Among his more than 50 publications, his report and now book, Who Will Feed China, did what no threatened Olympic boycott could. It scared the country's leaders into changing policy. As a journalist who believes 1 minute on site is more valuable than 100 hours researching a story on the phone, I find it extremely noteworthy that Les traveled the world as a young man, working in Indian, Lao, Burmese, and Vietnamese agricultural communities before he started to tell others about his worldview. Les Brown has been advocating an entirely new, I'd call it an entirely obvious and sensible, way of structuring an economy which factors in the ecological systems that support us, and he's been doing it for more than 3 decades. You want a sense of how prescient Les Brown is on this front? When do you think he wrote the following passage? Experts failed to anticipate the energy crisis, food shortages, double-digit global inflation, the abrupt alteration of the international political structure, the collapse of major fisheries, the astronomical rise in wheat prices, and a global economic slump unmatched since the Great Depression. Any guesses? Last week after the latest financial collapse, maybe? That was actually in his landmark 1978 book, The 29th Day. Someone say 1970-something. What is so vital about the work of Les Brown is not just his wake-up call, but his game plan. In a world saturated with plenty of fear, what we are short on is coherent suggestions for a solution. So many of his books and Earth Policy Institute reports state a problem, but end with an optimistic, if ambitious, plan or resolution. He bundles every boogeyman of a problem that keeps folks up at night, from shrinking ice sheets to hunger, growing desertification to poverty, with a strategy for dispelling it, and he recognizes profoundly that all these issues are interconnected. One of the things Les Brown does for humanity is he puts a timeline, as well as numbers, to the issue of what we must do, in fact, to survive as a species. This is like fourth quarter, folks. You're supposed to get a bit scared from many of Les Brown's books. After all, the message is that nothing less than a massive World War II-like mobilization is needed to save humanity. That's all of us, you and me. To be honest, I like the second half of his recent Plan B 3.0 best. That's where he suggests that all is not lost. And we listen, or we should, not just because of long-standing impeccable research and consistent message, but because in many key ways, this man who doesn't own a car walks the walk as well as talking the talk. Please welcome Lester Brown.
Thanks, Lester. Yeah. Thanks, Doug, for the introduction. I was a bit relieved when you didn't hold up the latest book, as the late Senator Paul Simon once did when he was introducing me, held up the book and said, "Lester's written the sort of book that once you put it down, you can't pick it up again." My other favorite book story took place many, many years ago. Not many of you will remember a woman named Liz Carpenter. She was Mrs. Lyndon Johnson's social secretary and a very talented woman. A talented speaker, a great writer, wrote some of LBJ's better speeches. And after the White House years, she wrote a book called Ruffles and Flourishes. And it was on the bestseller list, and she was on book tour. And one night in Atlanta, Georgia, she chanced to meet her former White House colleague, Arthur Schlesinger, in a hotel lobby. And he said, "Gee, Liz, I really enjoyed your book. Who wrote it for you?" She said, "Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, Arthur. Who read it to you?" One Washington story, then I'll get serious. This one also goes back a bit. You may remember when the detente was well underway and the Cold War was coming to an end, Mikhail Gorbachev was in Washington visiting. And it was a time of great excitement because of what was happening in the changing relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And as he was driving down K Street in downtown Washington, he stopped his motorcade, got out on the street and started shaking hands with American pedestrians, and it was quite a moment, and actually caught on film. And then sometime after that, he invited President Bush Sr. to this would have been probably 1990-91, invited President Bush to Moscow. And late one afternoon, after they'd finished their formal meetings and they were just sort of sitting back and relaxing, the two of them, and they were talking about the problems of governance. And Bush said, "You know, for me, one of the difficult things is finding the right person for each cabinet position." And and he said to Gorbachev, "You know, how do you go about doing that?" And Gorbachev said, "Well, I have a series of questions that I ask the potential candidates for a position." And Bush said, "Well, you know, like what?" He said, "Well, when I was interviewing Shevardnadze for the foreign minister position, the question I asked him was, 'Who is your father's son who's not your brother?'" And Bush said, "And what did he say?" And he said, "That's me, Shevardnadze." Oh, Bush was kind of taken with this. So when he got back to Washington, he got back to Washington and he called in Dan Quayle. And he said, "Danny, I have a question for you." "Yes, Mr. President?" He said, "Danny, who's your father's son who's not your brother?" "Can I get back to you on that, Mr. President?" So out he went, and for a day or two he was thinking about this, and he went by Henry Kissinger's office. He said, "Aha, Henry knows everything." So he went in, he said, "Henry, I have a question for you. Who is your father's son who's not your brother?" Kissinger said, "That's me." "Really?" "Yeah." "Thanks, Henry." So out he went. Down the hall. Mr. President, you know that question you asked me? Who's your father's son who's not your brother?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "It's Kissinger." So sometime later, Bush was calling Gorbachev about something, and he said, "Remember that question you asked Shevardnadze about who's your father's son who's not your brother?" He said, "I asked Dan Quayle that." And he said, "You know what he said? He said, 'It's Kissinger.' And I said, 'No, it's Shevardnadze.'" You can't see it, but there's a clock down here that says 45 minutes, so I'm going to get serious now. It's going to... Late last summer, as we were coming down the home stretch in the research and writing for Plan B 3.0, there was there were a number of stories on ice melting. You may remember some of them. One of them was on the melting of the ice in the Arctic Sea, and the scientists who were monitoring it pointed out there was an area of the size of the UK had melted in 1 week, and they were just flabbergasted by this. They had never seen the ice melting so fast before. And then there was a story from the scientists who were studying the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, and they were looking particularly at the Ilulissat glacial outflow. The Greenland ice sheet is huge. It's about a mile thick, and there are various points where it flows, the glaciers flow in into the sea. And the Ilulissat Glacier, Ilulissat must be an Inuit name, but it's about 3 miles wide, comes down through a valley, flowing through a valley. It's about 3 miles wide. The ice is a mile thick. And it was flowing not at 100 meters a year or 200 meters a year, which is typical for these glacial outflows, but 2 meters an hour. 2 meters an hour. I mean, you could almost watch it moving. And then periodically, huge chunks, 3 miles wide, a mile high, some hundreds of yards thick, would break off and slide into the ocean. When it did, it created a seismic response, a mini earthquake, if you will, when suddenly billions of tons of ice slid off into the sea. And the scientists there were stunned because they had never seen ice melting so fast. And it turns out that the ice melting in the interior was breaking down through cracks and what they call moulins, and the water was flowing to the sea under the glacier and was sort of lubricating and hastening the flow. The concern among scientists is that the Greenland ice sheet could melt at some point completely. If it does, sea level rises 23 feet. While we were focusing on these, scientists in China and India were looking at the melting of glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau. And they were pointing out that these glaciers are melting very fast. It is the ice melt from these glaciers that sustains the major rivers of Asia during the dry season, the Indus, the Ganges, the Mekong, the Yangtze, the Yellow River. And it is the water in these rivers that provides the irrigation water for many of the farmers in northern India and in much of China. If these glaciers disappear, as they are projected to, if we continue with business as usual, could disappear by mid-century, by 2060, according to the projections, then we would actually be seeing the most massive threat to world food security that we've ever been able to project. We forget that China is the world's leading producer of wheat. India is number two. We are number three. With rice, China and India totally dominate the world harvest. What happens to the wheat and rice harvest of Asia if these glaciers melt will affect food prices for everyone in the world. One of my concerns with climate change, on top of everything else, including population growth, rising food prices, rising oil prices, soil erosion, spreading water shortages, deforestation, a whole complex of trends, is that it is putting more stress on governments in low and middle income countries than many are able to deal with. So we have the phenomenon we now call failing states. And that list of failing states, countries like Somalia, Haiti, Afghanistan, the Sudan, Democratic Republic of the Congo, now increasingly Pakistan, this list of failing states is getting longer each year. And it raises a disturbing question, which is, how many failing states before we have a failing global civilization? We don't know the answer to that question. We've not been here before. But it's something I think we need to think about. If I were to pick one indicator, environmental, economic, or political, that's going to tell us more about our future than anything else, it would be the number of failing states in the world. In writing Plan B, the actual plan in Plan B 3.0, mobilizing to save civilization, we concluded we've got to cut carbon emissions fast. We didn't ask the question that political leaders usually ask, which, how much of a cut in carbon emissions is politically feasible? We asked another question. We asked, how much and how fast do we have to cut carbon emissions if we want to try to save the Greenland ice sheet, for example, or if we want to save the larger glaciers, at least the larger glaciers, in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau? When you pose that question, then it becomes clear that we have to cut carbon emissions fast. By fast, we calculate we have to cut them 80% by 2020. Now, some political leaders talk about cutting carbon emissions 80% by 2050. We think the game is going to be over long before then. We're going to have to move fast. In cutting carbon emissions, we have three components: systematically raising the efficiency of the world energy economy, number one; number two, massive investment in renewable sources of energy; and number three, arresting the deforestation and reforesting the earth, planting billions and billions of trees. Let me give a few examples. First, on efficiency. If we turn to the most efficient lighting system, the most efficient lighting technologies available on the market today, which is compact fluorescent bulbs, and if we replace all of the old-fashioned incandescent bulbs with these newer bulbs, we can cut electricity use worldwide by 12%. That would enable us to close 705 of the nearly 2,400 coal-fired power plants in the world today. That's just lighting. I could go through sector by sector. Enormous potential for increasing the efficiency, the energy efficiency of the world economy. Renewables. We're seeing the growth of renewable energy resources now on a scale and at a pace that even a year ago I would not have imagined. It's extraordinary. Now, up until recently, the increases in renewable energy development were largely incremental and marginal. Another wind farm here, maybe 100, 200, 300 megawatts, another solar installation there. But it was marginal. It wasn't very big in the global scheme of things. And now suddenly that's changed. And this change in mindset I don't fully understand, but it reminds me of a response by Amory Lovins to Elizabeth Colbert, writer for The New Yorker, when she was doing a profile of Amory for The New Yorker, I guess it was a year and a half or so ago. She asked Amory about thinking outside the box. Amory said, "There is no box. There is no box." And that's where we need to be today. And the exciting thing is we're beginning to see this. Consider, for example, the state of Texas. Texas has today 6,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity in production. It has 39,000 megawatts under construction or in the planning stages. Altogether, a total of 45,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity. Think 45 coal-fired power plants. This is huge. When these wind farms are completed, they will generate more electricity than the 24 million people living in Texas can consume. And it's happened so fast. 2 years ago, Texas overtook California as the leading wind generating state. And now suddenly we see this huge development. Or consider Philip Anschutz, once an oil man, more recently known for his acquisition of Quest, is building a 2,000 megawatt wind farm in Wyoming, very close to the Colorado border, just west of the Continental Divide. He has also acquired a company that has development rights for a transmission line from Wyoming to California, 900 miles. He is not interested in building that transmission line just for his 2,000 megawatt wind farm. I think we're going to see one day tens of thousands of wind generating capacity in Wyoming because it's great wind resources and no people. So that electricity is going to be going to California and other points in the Southwest. I could talk about other development projects in the U.S. The largest single wind farm now under development is in South Dakota, a joint project of BP and Clipper Wind Power, 5,050 megawatts in one wind farm right on the Iowa border. They have acquired the rights to an abandoned railroad that crosses Iowa, which is where the transmission line will go, feeding that electricity into the Illinois grid, which is a heavy-duty grid because they have a number of nuclear plants. That wind farm will generate five times as much electricity as the 760,000 people who live in South Dakota will consume. I mean, it's huge, and we've not seen this sort of thinking before, and I could go on with other examples. Scotland. The Scottish government is negotiating with two sovereign investment funds in the Middle East. Sovereign means sort of government investment funds. To build a grid off the east coast of Scotland in the North Sea, an offshore grid, $7 billion investment, and an undersea cable linking it to the continent. This will enable the Scots to develop 60,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity. The total electrical generation in the UK today is less than 100,000 megawatts. I mean, this is thinking on a huge scale. We've never seen this before with fossil fuels, for example. Turkey, last year, issued an invitation for bids to build wind farms in Turkey. The bidding was open to not only domestic firms, but international wind development companies. They got proposals to develop 78,000 megawatts of wind generating capacity. Turkey's current electricity generation total, 34,000 megawatts. When I was launching the Turkish edition of Plan B 3.0, I talked with the Turkish Minister of Energy about this, asking him how they were going to respond to all these proposals. And he said they were going to sort through them carefully. They were sorting through them. They're going to pick 15,000 megawatts to develop in the first wave. Indonesia. Indonesian government announced some weeks ago they plan to develop 6,800 megawatts of geothermal generating capacity. Indonesia, as I point out in Plan B 3.0, has over 500 volcanoes, 131 of which are active. So they have a lot of heat very near the surface. What they've done is give the primary responsibility for developing these geothermal generating resources to Pertamina, which is the state oil company. Indonesia's oil production peaked a few years back, has been declining since, and during the last 2 years, Indonesia's been a net importer of oil. Pertamina could become the first company, the first oil company, state or independent, to make the transition from oil to renewable energy resources. Algeria has said it's going to develop 6,000 megawatts of solar thermal capacity in the desert. Solar thermal mirrors concentrating sunlight on a a vessel containing water or some liquid, boiling it, generating electricity. They're going to lay a cable under the Mediterranean, undersea cable, export that electricity to Europe. Algeria today exports oil, but it knows it's not going to be exporting oil for that much longer. So it plans to continue exporting energy, but this time it will be electricity generated from solar energy. The Algerians point out that they have enough harnessable solar energy in their desert, and the desert is most of the country, to power the world economy. That almost sounds like it must be a mathematical error, but it's not. The way this point appears in the energy literature is that the amount of sunlight striking the earth in 1 hour will run the world economy for 1 year. We have an enormous amount of solar energy. In this country, three states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national electricity needs. That leaves 47 other states, all of which have some of them, a lot of wind energy. And a DOE study from a couple years ago says if we go offshore out to 50 miles, we have enough wind energy to provide 70% of the energy of the country's electricity. So we have an enormous amount of wind energy. One of the exciting things in developing wind resources in this country is that we now have two new technologies that together will enable us to build an entirely new automotive fuel economy. One of these is hybrid cars. Once you have hybrid cars, it's a short step to plug-in hybrids. And that's what four automobile manufacturers are moving toward. It appears that Toyota and GM are in the lead. Toyota, they've both said they'll be in the market in 2010. Toyota may make it next year with a plug-in version of the Prius. If so, they expect it will get over 100 miles per gallon because it will be running largely on electricity. The Chevrolet Volt, which is GM's first plug-in hybrid, they estimate under average American driving conditions will get 151 miles per gallon. That car will have an all-electric range of 40 miles. So if you just use it for commuting and local shopping and so forth, plug it in each night, you may never use any gasoline, just electricity. So we have some exciting new technologies now that will enable us to simultaneously reduce carbon emissions, reduce dependence on imported oil, and secure our energy resources. No one can embargo the wind. And the economics are exciting. The cost of a gasoline gallon equivalent of wind-generated electricity is less than $1. Less than $1. So it's not only environmentally exciting and politically exciting because we reduce our dependence on imported oil, but economically exciting as well. The question is, how do we get from here to there? Some things happen on their own. They don't even need government support and government policies. Let me just give you one example of that, and it's from China. A decade or so ago, a young Chinese engineer who was working for one of the state oil companies designed and built for himself a rooftop solar water heater. His real passion was solar energy, but there was no place to get a job when he was looking for one at that time, so he worked for one of the oil companies. After he put this on his house, some of his relatives and friends wanted him, so he started building some more, and then more and more people wanted him. He started a company. Today, his company has 5,000 sales outlets in China And there are at least another 200 companies also making these rooftop solar water heaters. The way that he marketed them was to go into a village with these and just set them up on the ground. They don't have to be on the rooftop. You can put them on the ground, put some water in them, let them heat up. And then he would ask a villager for an egg, drop the egg in the water, 10 minutes later pull it out, give it back to the villager, hard-boiled. They got it. Today, 40 million homes in China get their hot water from rooftop solar water heaters. And it's growing every day. The government's had nothing to do with this. It's all happened on its own. But there are many things, particularly with younger industries, where we need to provide support. And the key in getting from here to there is to get the market to tell the environmental truth. The market does many things well. One of the things it does not do is to incorporate the indirect costs of burning fossil fuels. When we buy a gallon of gasoline, we pay the cost of pumping the oil out of the ground, of moving that oil to a refinery, then getting the gasoline to the local service station. We do not pay the cost of climate change. We do not pay the cost of treating respiratory illnesses from breathing polluted air. We do not pay the cost in the price of gasoline of damage from acid rain. So the challenge is to get the market to tell the environmental truth. And that means lowering income taxes and offsetting that with a rise in the carbon tax. We don't change the amount of tax we pay, only what we tax. Al Gore's coined a phrase, let's tax what we burn, not what we earn. And that really does capture the essence of this. So it's restructuring taxes. If you asked economists, did a poll of economists, probably 95% would say that's the way to do it. The other option is a so-called cap-and-trade arrangement where we put limits on carbon emissions and let companies bid for the right to emit carbon, whether it's a coal-fired power plant or embodied in automobiles or what have you. We'll probably end up with a combination of both. Sir Nicholas Stern, formerly chief economist at the World Bank, was asked by the UK government to do a study on the future costs of global climate change, future costs for the world. He began that study by saying that climate change was the result of a massive market failure. And by that, he meant that because we had not included the costs of climate change in the prices of coal-fired electricity or gasoline, we were encouraging climate change simply because we were not including all the costs. Some of you will remember, and he also, incidentally, thinks the best way to proceed is to restructure taxes. Some of you will remember a U.S. corporation called Enron. In the late 1990s, it was on the cover of more business magazines than any corporation in the country. It was a remarkable success story. At one point, when its shares were trading for $97, it was the seventh most valuable corporation in the United States, according to its stock value. Its earnings just kept going up and up and up. Wall Street always looked forward to the quarterly reports. Extraordinary. And then, in late 2001, some outside accountants began looking at Enron. And what they discovered was that the employees at Enron had devised some rather ingenious ways of leaving costs off the books. And when that audit was finished, and they realized that Enron was worthless, it was bankrupt. We are doing exactly what Enron did, but on a far larger scale. We are leaving costs off the books, big time. And the inevitable consequence of that, if we continue, is bankruptcy, because eventually those costs catch up with you. In fact, we've been doing some of that in recent years, which accounts for, at least in part, for the economic crisis we're in today. Most of us here have been talking about sustainable development and sustainable ways of doing things. But it's, and as one who was involved in the early thinking and coining of the terms, I've come to realize that sustainable development is not a very exciting term. I mean, the alternative to sustainable development is unsustainable development, which means eventually decline and collapse. That's what happened to earlier civilizations. It moved on to an economic path that was environmentally unsustainable, the Sumerians or the Mayans or what have you. What's at stake now? Let me put it this way. We as environmentalists have been talking for decades now about the need to save the planet. But what we're really looking at is trying to save civilization itself. This is what's at stake. I mentioned earlier, as the number of failing states keeps increasing, it weakens our global civilization. Failing states cannot help control the international spread of communicable diseases, like polio or SARS or Asian flu or what have you. We depend on a very well-developed international system for controlling the spread of infectious diseases. When states fail, there's no one to assume the responsibility for their debt. Again, more and more failing states would threaten the integrity of the already heavily stressed international economic system. I think we're at a point where we need to think about mobilizing to save civilization. And that means stabilizing climate, stabilizing population, eradicating poverty, and restoring the natural systems on which the global economy depends: aquifers, forests, soils, fisheries, etc. When I think about how much we need to do and how little time in which we have to do it, it's easy to become discouraged, but I often go back and reread some of the economic history of World War II. December 7th, 1941, Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor sunk a large part of the U.S. Pacific Fleet while it was at anchor in the harbor, in Pearl Harbor. If you had conducted a poll on December 6, 1941, on Saturday, and asked the question of the American people, do you think we should go to war or not? Probably 95% would have said, nothing doing. If you had waited to Monday, December 8, 1941, and asked that same question, probably 95% would have said, yes, we've got to go to war. On January 6th, 1942, President Roosevelt gave his State of the Union address. This is 1 month after Pearl Harbor. And in that address, he laid out U.S. arms production goals. Keep in mind, we were still a Depression-era economy at the time. He said, we're going to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, 20,000 anti-aircraft and artillery guns, and thousands of ships. We were faced with an enormous logistical challenge of fighting two major wars on the far side of two oceans. And we're starting from essentially square one. When people saw these production goals, ships and tanks and planes, on this scale, there was a lot of public skepticism. But what Roosevelt and his colleagues realized was that at that time, the largest single concentration of industrial power in the world was in the U.S. automobile industry, because even during the Depression, we were making 2 or 3 million cars a year. So after he gave his State of the Union address, laid out the arms production goals, he called in the leaders of the automobile industry, and he said to them, because you guys represent such a large share of our industrial capacity, we're going to rely heavily on you to help us reach these arms production goals. And they say, well, Mr. President, we'll do everything we can, but it's going to be a stretch producing cars and all these arms too. He said, you don't understand. We're going to ban the sale of private automobiles in the United States. And that's exactly what happened. From the beginning of April 1942 until the end of 1944, almost 3 years, there were essentially no cars produced in the United States. And we exceeded every one of those arms production goals. We didn't produce 60,000 planes. We produced 129,000 planes. Fighters, bombers, reconnaissance planes, troop transports, cargo transports. Even today, it's difficult to imagine producing 129,000 planes. But the point of this World War II example is this. It did not take decades for us to restructure the U.S. industrial economy. It did not take years. We did it in a matter of months. If we could restructure the U.S. industrial economy in a matter of months then, we certainly can restructure the world energy economy over the next dozen years. In Plan B 3.0, we have the goal of producing 3 million megawatts of wind generating capacity by 2020. Today, the world gets 40% of its electricity from coal. We plan to back out all of the coal-fired power and go entirely to renewables, wind being the centerpiece of the economy, not by any means the only source of renewables. I forgot to mention geothermal energy in the U.S. A few years ago, there was nothing happening in this country. Today, there are 96 geothermal projects in various stages of development in the western part of the United States. It's gone from nothing to like this. Three million megawatts, 1.5 million turbines, 2 megawatts each. Sounds like a lot of wind turbines, a lot of manufacturing, and it is. But the world produces 65 million cars a year. In the United States, we have how many automobile assembly plants now idled? Workers out of a job. If you saw Ken Burns' film, The War, which I think was a year ago in September, you may remember a series on the Ford Willow Run plant in Michigan. That plant covers, as I remember, 78 acres. And they showed the footage of B-24 bombers coming off the assembly line. If you can produce B-24 bombers on assembly lines, you can produce wind turbines on assembly lines. We could produce, using only idled U.S. automobile assembly plants, we could produce all the wind turbines for the world to meet this goal easily by 2020. So we can do it if it becomes important for us to do so. Today, we are in a race between tipping points. Natural tipping points and political tipping points. Can we close coal-fired power plants fast enough to save the Greenland ice sheet? To save at least the larger glaciers in the Himalayas? Can we arrest the deforestation in the Amazon before it so weakens the Amazon it becomes vulnerable to natural fire and then is beyond our saving it? These are the questions that we need to be asking and that we need to be answering. I've wondered what would happen if, say, 3 years from now, the National Academy of Sciences in Washington were to announce publicly that the Greenland ice sheet, the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, had reached the point of no return and we can no longer stop it. This is a hypothetical example, not a projection. But how would that affect us? How does our generation respond to the younger generation, those graduating from college today? We would be leaving them a world facing a 23-foot rise in sea level with hundreds of millions of rising sea refugees, potentially chaos in the world. Many of the world's coastal cities would be underwater. All of the rice-growing river deltas and floodplains of Asia would be underwater. I mean, try to imagine what this would translate into. What we could see is, for the first time in history, social fracturing along generational lines. We have seen social fracturing along racial lines, ethnic lines, religious lines, but never before along generational lines. We may have to answer these questions one day. We need to be thinking now if there's any way of avoiding having to answer the questions. My final point is that saving civilization is not a spectator sport. It's something we all need to get involved in. We all have a stake. Most of us have youngsters. Many of us have grandchildren. We need to get involved politically. And I don't mean just in presidential campaigns, though that's obviously important in this country. I hear Europeans say they ought to have a vote in the United States because what we do affects them so much. And they're right. What we do or don't do, as the case may be, has an enormous effect on the rest of the world. Get involved. Pick an issue. Join the movement to oppose new coal-fired power plants. Get involved with a population group that's working internationally to stabilize world population. Work to develop a state-of-the-art recycling program in your community where almost everything is recycled or composted. We can do these things. We can build an economy that will sustain civilization, but it's going to take an enormous effort. One of the most exciting things happening in the world today, I think, I've talked about one, and that's the enormous increase in the scale of thinking and investment in renewable energy resources. Another is the power of the political movement in this country opposing the construction of new coal-fired power plants. In May of 2007, a year and a half ago, the U.S. Department of Energy published a study which was subtitled The Resurgence of Coal-Fired Power. And what they pointed out in that study was that for the last 10 or 15 years, we've been building almost entirely natural gas-fired power plants. They're cleaner, and for a while they were cheap. But then as the price of natural gas kept going up, they became less and less competitive. So the industry, in looking for alternatives, did what was easiest for them. They simply went back to coal. That's what they knew. That report contained a list of 151 planned or proposed new coal-fired power plants in the United States. As of today, more than 70 of those plants are off the list, either because state governments refuse to license them, as in, say, Kansas or Florida, many other states, or because local opposition became so strong that the utilities quietly abandoned their plants. It's been a fascinating political situation because we have state attorneys general in California, New York, several other states in the Northeast, seven or eight of them, banding together. These are states that are trying to reduce their carbon emissions, by the way, at the state level. They've banded together to write letters to governors in other states urging them not to approve the construction of new coal-fired power plants. I mean, it's an interesting internal political dynamic. The other interesting thing is that Wall Street has joined in this. And back in early February, three investment banks, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Morgan Stanley, then later joined by Bank of America, issued their carbon principles, in which they said they would no longer lend to utilities to build coal-fired power plants unless the utilities could demonstrate their economic viability after the government imposes restrictions on carbon emissions. And what that means is that no one can demonstrate economic viability because no one knows what those restrictions will be. Wall Street has effectively turned its back on the coal industry. And this is a major development. And it didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened because groups like Rainforest Action Network and Sierra and other NRDC and other national groups met with the investment bankers. And, you know, they realized that if they could cut off the capital flow, it would have an enormous effect. It is quite possible that by the end of this year, we will be very close to a de facto moratorium on new coal-fired power plants in the United States. What's so interesting to me about this? I mean, we're talking about another round of climate negotiations of post-Kyoto Protocol. My own sense is that that model is now obsolete. It takes so long to negotiate and then to ratify, years and years, and we don't have that much time anymore. And these agreements never really are very ambitious because no country wants to go to these international negotiations and come back appearing to have conceded more than someone else. So you get these minimalist sort of advances. What I think is going to happen is that individual countries are going to begin to move ahead on their own. Living in Washington, D.C., as I do, I find it fascinating to be in touch with some of the leaders in this movement. And official Washington and those who represent us at these international climate negotiations. They're two entirely different cultures. And the interesting thing about those who are participating in this effort to ban new coal-fired power plants in the U.S. and, in effect, to bring construction of new plants to an end. At no point have they said, we will do this if Europe does it, if China does it, the rest of the world does it. They simply said, this is what we want to do. And I think that's how it's going to happen. I begin the last chapter of the book describing New Zealand under the leadership of Prime Minister Helen Clark. Remarkable story. They're really working to cut carbon emissions. And they've begun to talk about becoming a carbon neutral country. That is, there will be no net carbon emissions. The question is not whether you cut by 20% or 80%, but it'll be zero. That's the kind of thinking we need. Norway has also adopted this goal. I believe Iceland has also, and Costa Rica. Why couldn't we do this in the United States if they can do it? I think we can, but it's up to you and me. Saving civilization is not a spectator sport. We all need to get involved. And if you don't remember anything else I've said tonight, I'll be very happy if you can remember that. We've got to do it, you and I. No one else is going to do it for us. Thank you all so much for coming out tonight.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, am I on? Can you hear me? Good. Thank you so much for that, that call to action. We had on December 7th, 1941, as you described, a single incident that mobilized society. So using that sort of metaphor of a World War II-like call to action, what, if anything, other than what you've said, individuals get involved, what might inspire the political will to bring about that kind of massive shift?
If I could quote one of my heroes, T. Boone Pickens. In this case, he said the right thing. He was asked why he, an oil man, for 60 years, he's 80 years old now, was suddenly investing all this money, $10 billion, in a 4,000-megawatt wind farm in the Texas Panhandle. I mean, the implication of the question was, you know, have you lost it? You know, and he said very simply, I'm tired of oil depletion curves. And what he was implicitly acknowledging is that when you invest in a new oil field, you know it'll be a matter of decades and the yield of the wells will begin to decline. If you invest in a coal mine, the seams will run out. Then you have to find some new coal someplace. But when you invest in a wind farm and the associated infrastructure, you're investing in an energy system that can last as long as the Earth itself. Obviously you have to replace the bearings and, you know, there's a maintenance factor. But the wind's not going to run out. And I think it's the excitement associated with that recognition that we can actually build an energy system that will basically last forever. That's pretty exciting when you think about it, because ever since the Industrial Revolution began, we've been investing in energy systems that we knew were going to run out. And so I think it's this excitement that's beginning to drive some of this thinking that we're beginning to see. And I gave a scattering of examples around the world of how, you know, we're seeing these quantum jumps in looking at the potential, what we can do with renewable energy. So my sense is that realization of what we're starting to do may begin to drive itself and create its own excitement, which I think it is. And so for us individually, it's a matter of helping that process along, and whether it's opposing coal-fired power plants or raising energy efficiency or what have you, I think there's a real chance for us to get involved. Now, you were asking about Pearl Harbor, and I thought the question you were going to ask was, what could be the Pearl Harbor on the environment front that would suddenly mobilize everything? Maybe we have to hope there won't be one, because it could be a point of no return sort of thing. But if I were to, I was asked by a novelist recently to suggest something that could trigger a major response and maybe get us on the path to a sustainable civilization. And I think if you talk with most climate scientists, they would say the most likely one would be the breakup of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Most of the Antarctic ice sheet is on the continent itself. But on the western part, there's a scattering of islands that supports, I don't know, maybe 15% of the total Antarctic ice sheet. And what their scientists are beginning to realize is that that ice is melting very fast. And the reason for that is that both the surface temperature of the air is rising, but the temperature of the water beneath the ice sheet is also rising. And if that begins to break up, then we would see a rise of 15 feet in sea level. And if it became clear that that was starting to happen, the idea that we're going to see in a relatively short period of time, maybe a few decades, a huge rise in sea level, would really, I think, wake us up.
Joe the plumber would say, let's really get those auto industry, empty auto factories working to make those wind turbines.
I thought I was going to get a break from Joe the plumber
today. I'm Joe the wind farm manager. I'm just, without mentioning any names, we obviously have this election coming up, so ignoring... ignoring a drill.
What election is that, Doug?
There's a school board. the drill, leaving out drill baby drill as a viable policy for the future of humankind. We had Roosevelt saying, December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. And so I don't want to belabor the point, because there's so much else I want to discuss with you. But if a nameless next president. Makes a first State of the Union, do you believe that there's an argument that can be made that would rally at least U.S. Citizens to say, we are going to revamp this economy starting today, or else?
Yes, and I think at the heart of that would be two or three things. One would be the realization we're in economic crisis. We're losing huge numbers of jobs every month. And one of the priorities of the new president is going to be to create jobs. The exciting thing is that I think the huge job growth in the years ahead will be in the energy economy, both investing in energy efficiency and in renewables. In the same way that during the 1990s, information technology was the huge growth industry. I mean, until we finally hit the bubble, when was it, 2001 or two? But it was huge. And I think we will see the same thing. So if you marry two or three different things, one is the need for jobs. It's not going to come in nuclear power plants. It's not going to come with drilling for oil. It's going to come from renewables and investing in energy efficiency. And the great thing about these jobs is they're local jobs. You can't outsource the weatherization of buildings to China. The second thing is the huge amount of capital that's flowing out of the U.S. now each year to import oil. At $150 a barrel, we would very soon be spending $700 billion a year on imported oil. Why not keep that capital at home and invest it here to create jobs? And that, I think, really sets the stage for an all-out effort. And it includes the automobile industry shifting rapidly to plug-in hybrid cars, more in a wartime mobilization sort of way than their current frame of mind, which is actually stretched out over a number of years and doesn't deal with huge numbers of cars. If you really wanted to get this economy cranking, if you began offering, if you began manufacturing on a mass scale, millions of plug-in hybrids each year, and use them to replace the least efficient vehicles on the road, the large SUVs, for example, and provided incentives to do that, imagine how fast we could reduce that $700 billion a year and how much of it we could keep at home. And then the third thing is climate change. With each passing month, there's new news from somewhere in the world, not even each month, each week of evidence of climate change and its negative effects. Ice melting is the one. You really don't have to go beyond ice melting to see that our civilization is in trouble. And avoiding reaching the point of no return in some of these areas like Greenland really means cutting carbon emissions fast. So we have this convergence of historical trends and concerns, the economic crisis, need to create jobs, the need to curb the outflow of dollars for oil, the need to create jobs, all coming together to create a single exciting package that really addresses not just the economic issues, but the security issues that we're facing in the world today. Unless we can get some of these things under control, our country, our economy and our country will just get weaker and weaker.
Moving to back to the individual perspective for a second, one of the things that I often hear from people is that they're concerned about these issues, they're aware of issues, especially things like climate change, and then the pain in the pocketbook from high resource prices, but they feel almost paralyzed by a fear and not knowing where to begin as an individual. You said pick an issue during your talk. What else can you say to an individual that's saying, I have a job and a family, I'm busy, there's soccer practice to take the kids to. What can I do to be really a part of the solution?
I mentioned the movement in opposition to new coal-fired power plants because there are thousands and thousands of people across the country involved in that. It's being orchestrated to some degree by Sierra at the national level, and the Earth Justice Legal Fund lawyers are doing a lot of the legal work. But the fire in the belly for this movement is coming from the local level. I remember giving a talk in Denver some months ago at the Tattered Cover bookstore, and there was a delegation of women there from Wyoming. They were, probably many of them, retired. And they were on the front line in Wyoming of opposing new coal-fired power plants. I mean, it's not, if they'd been college students, you know, you would expect it. But this was another generation who were beginning to see that we have some problems as a society, as a civilization, and they were weighing in. I mean, it was a very heartwarming experience to meet them and to have them there.
This is a slight change in topic now. If anybody hasn't read Plan B 3.0, I really recommend going through. Before you read it, finish something nice and light and funny. Not that 3.0 isn't well written, but there's policy dynamic to it, especially in the first half of the book, which is the uh-oh, and the second half is the solutions. And so a question that I have is, clearly, I'm getting into the sort of open space deforestation prevention and forest regeneration angle of things. Given I know all these issues are tied together, but given the sort of monstrous population growth that we've already experienced, even if it's stabilized now, again, this is a question I often ask, and I'm thinking, I can't wait to ask Les Brown this. So how do we reconcile tens or hundreds of millions of new people's needs for home with we can't cut down trees anymore, or we want to preserve open space? People sometimes make me feel as though I'm sort of anti-human by saying, while open space, wilderness, and forest preservation is important, what about the people? So how do you address that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a number of things to think about if we think about housing, for example. One is, in this country, what you see when you're flying. If you're flying from the south coming into Washington, you see miles and miles of these suburban developments, McMansions, big houses, literally about this far apart. I mean, it's the aesthetics of this elude me somehow.
the feng shui.
but developers discovered that if they built bigger houses, they could charge more for them. And it's just like Detroit, discovering the profit margins on SUVs are much greater than they are for a small car. So we've had this splurge. We need to think about, and there's often not a sense of community in these communities. And you can't get anywhere without a car. You can't go shopping. You can't get to the dry cleaners. You can't get to a restaurant. We need to begin rethinking what community is all about and what it takes to build community. I mean, this is beginning to happen. But in terms of housing and thinking of material use, I think we ought to be looking much more at mixed housing, where we have townhouses, where we have small apartment buildings and individual dwellings and combined in a way that does not usually use nearly as much material. I mean, I happen to live in an apartment in downtown Washington. It's in a very pleasant neighborhood looking out over Rock Creek Park. An old apartment house was built in 1929, but I have a one-bedroom apartment. I couldn't be happier. And I wouldn't trade it for a dozen of those McMansions out in Virginia or Maryland or someplace. I mean, they're not civilized? I mean, I don't know what it is, but I hope none of you live in. But I think we've got a lot of rethinking to do, and the idea that bigger and bigger is better, whether it's cars or houses. We're seeing an interesting development in this country called the Complete Streets Movement, which is now being legislated in a number of states, and there's national legislation that's been introduced by Senator from Tom from Iowa. Harkin, Tom Harkin. But the Complete Street Movement requires that when streets, roads are being built, that they accommodate not just cars, but bicycles and pedestrians. And interestingly, there's a huge push, not just by environmental groups like NRDC and bicycle groups and community groups, but the AARP, 17 million strong, is pushing this hard. And the reason is there are a lot of communities, and I've noticed them especially in the southeastern United States, that were built without sidewalks. And so if you don't have a car, it's very difficult to walk, because particularly if it's a main street, there's fast-moving traffic, and it's just very uncomfortable and a bit dangerous. And what's happened is that older residents living in these houses who can no longer drive for physical reasons or can't afford to are trapped. They can't go anywhere. And suddenly this is dawning on people, that this is really poor planning. And so the AARP is pushing for the Complete Streets Movement. So there are things happening in this country that are exciting, or the use of bicycles in cities. I mean, Paris has become sort of the poster city for this with their 2,000 bike stands now, just a credit card, and you get a bike and you put it back in a credit card again. Very simple system, working really well. But it's that kind of thinking, I think, is going to that we need now, and it's very different from the thinking that's got us where we are.
I think also complementing the Complete Streets mentality is realities like Spain is requiring solar power in all new structures, private and business, that are being built. In this part of the world, of course, we have to think about water sustainability, and I believe that should be worked in by law for any kind of new development, things like reclaiming wastewater, rain catchment, drip irrigation, that kind of thing, rezoning so that home people can have gardens and small amounts of livestock wherever they live. So that maybe I can transition to a food question. We discussed this a little bit earlier today over breakfast, but I wanted to to raise it in front of the audience, which is I think a lot of us associate terms like sustainability and just general health, healthy living with an idea of what you might call an organic mentality. So, for instance, I would guess that if we could get the house lights, I don't know if we can, but if we could get the house lights on the audience and say how many of you really watch when you're shopping for organic versus so-called conventional, meaning poison food, how many of you would go organic? And I would bet we would see a vast majority saying they shop for organic. But in Plan B 3.0, you have to, the nature of the book, you're trying to save civilization here. You're doing broad strokes about, okay, China's production was this many billion tons and India's was this much, and so we need to stabilize this population at this much tons. Essentially, though, when we say, let's say, wheat, we're talking probably about the latest, greatest, probably GMO type stuff. I would say to a majority of this audience, boo me if I'm wrong, but to a large majority of this audience, that is anathema. They probably wouldn't touch GMO stuff. So what I asked you this morning, and I'll sort of ask you again just to see where we can go with it, is am I naive to think that the future of food can include feeding the earth without genetic modification or dangerous pesticides or petroleum-based fertilizers?
Yes. Now, I think organic agriculture has a role to play, and in many cases, a highly desirable role. But what we have created is a global civilization that's now highly urbanized. I mean, worldwide, over half of us now live in cities. We are an urban species. And what that means is that we've disrupted the nutrient cycle. We use nutrients to produce food in one place, and that food goes hundreds of miles or thousands of miles if it's international, traded internationally, as a lot of food is today, and it ends up, the nutrients end up in the water systems, and we have dead zones and all sorts of, and disease problems. So what we need to think about is how to close that nutrient loop. I mean, we look at the U.S. as a country, we export close to 100 million tons of grain per year. And that carries with it each year 2 or 3 million tons of plant nutrients, phosphate, potash, nitrates, the basic nutrients in plant metabolism. And so if we keep exporting, then we keep losing nutrients unless we can replace them. And the only way that we can replace them now is to mine phosphate or potash or use a lot of energy to fix nitrogen synthetically and return it to the soil. So we have this this dilemma. There's another way of looking at it as food and energy intersect in that during the last century, we saw the globalization of the world energy economy as more and more countries, as countries everywhere, turned to oil, much of it coming from a small number of countries in the Middle East. And so with that, we had the globalization of the world energy economy. I mean, it could not have been much more globalized. Now, as we move toward renewables, we're seeing the localization of the energy economy, and a world economy based on renewable sources of energy will almost by definition be local. We'll see the localization of energy. With the localization of energy, of the energy economy, comes the localization of the food economy. So this is another dimension of the change in the food economy. And one of the most exciting things that we've seen in this country is the enormous growth, as you very well know, of farmers markets in this country, connecting people with farmers in their communities again. And it's become almost, it has an important social dimension. And it's the energy crisis, and peak oil and beyond, is going to be a world very different than the one that we've spent our lifetimes in. Once world oil production peaks, and it may already have, and starts down, no country gets more oil unless another gets less, and that's a very different world. But what we need to think about is what this translates into in transportation, in food production and processing and marketing. And it clearly is leading to localization. As someone said, for someone living in the East, that the days of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad are limited, you know? And that sums it up. So what you're doing on your farm is trying to work through some of these things and see how you can produce food sustainably. And that's what we clearly need to be doing for the world. And I think that we can greatly reduce pesticide use. And that's where most of the contamination comes from. I doubt very much, with 6.5 billion people in the world, half of us living in cities, that we're going to be able to eliminate the use of fertilizer.
I see that we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask one other question, and of course, would feel free to mention anything else that you think needs to be heard tonight. But the call to arms, the shift to a sort of World War II type mentality that we're talking about now cannot simply be a U.S. call to arms. It's a worldwide call to arms. You've been now several generations of leaders. I mean, you started doing policy work in the 60s. Do you feel? I mean, you've met with Chinese leaders, but given the fact that we have Russian militarism, some radical regimes in Iran and other places, failing states in Africa, do you have a sense of optimism that there could be a worldwide sort of post-Pearl Harbor call to arms for worldwide humanity's mutual benefit to move to a sustainable future?
If the U.S. leads, I think the world will follow. The world desperately wants leadership now, and if, not only have we not been leading, we have been opposing those who tried to lead. Not a healthy situation. So, my own sense is that we are on the edge of enormous change in the world. And I hope it's going to be the sort of change that will avoid a world descending into chaos. But the reason I talked about what's happening with renewable energy is because it is happening on a scale and at a speed that even I could not have imagined a year ago. We've been doing Plan B every 2 years. I feel like now we have to do it every year because things are happening so fast. I see we're down to zero. Can I close, closing point? This is a story. Not many of you in the audience will remember the name Will Durant, but Will... there are a few. Will Durant had the rare good fortune. I mean, among other things, he and his wife Ariel, he was at Columbia and married one of his graduate students, Ariel, and they wrote a 13-volume economic history of the world that came out, I've forgotten, maybe the 1940s or so. And but as a doctoral student, he had the rare good fortune of having his dissertation published as a book. And a couple of years after it was published, he got a letter from McGraw-Hill saying that it was no longer selling. They had 900 copies left, which they were going to remainder unless he wanted them. If he wanted them, he could have them. So he lived, actually, he and Ariel lived not far from the McGraw-Hill warehouse in northern New Jersey. So they went up and loaded up these books and brought them home, and they had just set up housekeeping, were sort of newly married, and he had a study that was lined with bookshelves, and he had about 100 books of his own, but he had all this shelf space. So they brought in the books and filled his study with copies of his book. And sometime later, he was writing to a friend in Europe, and he said, Ariel and I are now settled down housekeeping, and we're enjoying life very much, and so forth. And he said, oh, and by the way, he said, I now have a library of 1,000 volumes, 900 of which I've written myself. Now, lest I end up with such a library, The books are on sale where? And then we're back.
Keep up the good work. Thank you, Lester Brown, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks, Doug. Great job.
You too.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.